and where we are met with cynicism and doubt, and those who tell us that we can't, we will respond with that timeless creed that sums up the spirit of a people. Yes, we can. Yes, 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 it's time. We all come together. Ha-ha! Barack Obama.
Yes, we can, yeah.
Barack Obama. Man, he's coming with a message for the people saying, yes, we can, sure. Si se puede, today is a new day. So come on and throw your hands up, every woman, every man. Barack Obama.
Yes, we can, yeah.
Barack Obama.
Everybody, and welcome to Galactic Roundtable with Beth True Twin. We will spend the next little while working together on our ascension. We will work on personal, planetary, galactic, universal, omniversal, and cosmic ascension. The cosmos beyond describes all the non-physical antimatter universes. As we creator gods came to this part of the Nebadon universe, aeons ago, we birthed through Mother Sekhmet's Yani at Galactic Center. The end of time has been prophesied in many ethnic cultures for thousands of years. Last summer, August 17th, 2010, the Milky Way galaxy aligned with the sun. This marked the constellation movements of the Mayan calendar. It came sooner than the predicted December 21st, 2012. Time has speeded up due to the collective consciousness of totality and divine grace of all that is, raising their vibrations in a constant process of ascension to a level where we have surpassed the conjunct of the Milky Way with the sun. We are in the end times. It marks the end of the grand experiment of good and evil, of duality. It marks the end of the fallen angels on Earth planet. With their removal, we will become the 33rd member of the Intergalactic Confederation of Worlds. We all have incarnated in physical bodies on Earth to change from a planet of duality to a planet of peace. We are working with the Syrian commander, Barack Obama, who is the 9th member of the Syrian Council of Nine on Sirius A. His head of Secret Service is a physical template of Lord Sananda, who we call King of Swords. Millions of walk-in souls living in human bodies are all telepathically connected and working together in every walk of life. Police, Interpol, government agencies, military, lawyers, judges, journalists, and too many to list here. Each of us play an important role, where the outcome will be the capture and arrest of the intergalactic war criminals, the fallen angels, who were trying to have Earth and her resources as their own, as well as tens of other planets. We, on the ground crew, work closely with the Galactic Federation, headed by the Admiral Lord Sananda, a higher aspect of the Prophet Jesus, also known as Yeshua, and the Captain, Lord Ashtar. They have full say in many of the aspects of this mission for Earth ascension. They work directly with President Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama, as well as millions of other white knights around the world. They ask that we call on them as we need to for more help in our lives to help us with our mission. Feel free to call on them and they will be there at your service. You play an important part in this as you wake up to truth and share the news with others. We must work together to dissolve the programming within the Matrix. I will be pre-recording this program every week. I will be doing it recorded, not live, because it is better for my life situation. It is also less expensive to do a program without the use of an engineer answering the calls and monitoring. I want to thank BBS Radio, the greatest internet radio in the galaxy, for inviting me to be here each week. This is our family and where we join to check in with each other at galacticroundtable.com. I keep this site up to date every day as part of my spiritual service. I have 2 volunteers working with me, and they lovingly devote their service every day. I'm grateful for all who are part of the family at Galactic Roundtable. I manage to keep everything going with your donations, and you may find a donation button on the site. I use the money for electric, Wi-Fi, server fees, and radio broadcasting. I thank you, everybody, for your continuous generosity and love. In exchange, I work hard to give back as much as possible, and you may look at my other website, www.cosmicascension.com. I'm continuously adding to it, and there are many features for self-discovery and healing. This is a place where we go and we raise the questions, where am I? Who am I? Where am I from? And why am I here? I am beginning my charitable mission for World Service post-Nasara. You can find information about Antares Arcturus Midway Foundation at aamidway.com. And as we carry out lives of service to our fellow women, child, and men on Earth inside the Matrix, we continue to have tests and challenges from that concept that I affectionately call 3D. The first dimension is a point in space. The second dimension is a plane, a flat, barren surface. The third dimension is latitude. Imagine a cube with six planes connected together, the top, bottom, and four sides, floating up and down. Within this cube is the third dimensional space. The fourth dimension is time, pure and simple, a point in space in relation to time on a timeline in a dimension. The fifth dimension is the etheric realm with no time. We exist there simultaneously now. We travel in our etheric bodies to the etheric realms at night when we sleep. Our etheric bodies are known by many names, such as our avatar body, like Jake Sully and Neytiri, the lion woman, in the movie Avatar. They are also known as our cosmic consciousness. We are multidimensional beings living on multidimensional Earth as one people, one land, one love. Welcome to Galactic Roundtable on BBSRadio.com, Station 2, where we will discuss all things galactic with divine grace in the totality of all that is. Welcome. Greetings, everybody. Welcome to Galactic Roundtable. I'm so happy to have you back. I have so much to share tonight. I haven't talked to you in a couple of weeks because last week I did a repeat. I'm very happy to let you know that I have completed writing my first book. And that is why I took the week off last week. I needed extra time. And this has been an absolute devotional of love. I have enjoyed this project more than anything I've ever done. And I hope that you enjoy it as much as I have. This book is over 3,500 pages long. And the reason is there are 11 complete works included in the book, along with commentary and suggestions on how to read them and what they're about and the spiritual meaning of them. These books are our galactic heritage. Our galactic ancestors wrote them and hid them. And it's time that we take them out and dust them off and use them for their purpose of enlightenment. I have found out things in these books that I've looked at before that are new. This book that I've written was completely channeled. It was a challenge because I stayed very high energy channeling the information. They would show me where to look and what to say about it, and they showed me gems inside these books that I had never known before. Also, I was shown more deeply, being a Westerner, the connections between Judaism and Islam and Hinduism that I had never known before. I would have to include Buddhism too. There is this thread through all of these religions that shows that we're all the same, and they're all completely the same. I was surprised. So in an introduction chapter, then I explain each one. And then in the following chapters, I go into these important works. And they come from all major religions around the world. And how this sacred galactic scripture is our key to ascension and enlightenment. And what is contained in here. And this 3,500 pages isn't necessarily meant to, you know, sit down and read it from cover to cover. It's set up so that you can scroll through it, jump around, check out what interests you. Your spirit guides and your higher self will guide you to the information that you need today. And this is a loving gift from me, something that you can treasure and keep for years to come. And you will never grow tired of this book. I know I haven't. And several of these works, I've read the complete works now, getting ready, preparing to make this book. And some of them I still have a lot more reading to do. It's a lot of fun. You will be surprised how euphoric you feel, because when you discover these mysteries, which we had been poking at the tip of the iceberg over the years, but when you really look at them and see how simple it is, and you see the truth staring at you like that, truly it's dumbfounding. And it's a very happy experience. I feel that having everybody at the Galactic Roundtable and the interchanges we have talking to each other every day is the happiest I've ever been in my life. And this group, this family, means so much to me, and it's a great honor to share this work with you. So this is an ebook. It doesn't make sense at the moment to publish it in paper because it's over 3,500 pages long. That may happen in the future. I have that option open. It will be available on Amazon, and it's being released next Wednesday. And I will, as soon as I can, put out a portion of it for you to read for free. And understand and know that my family and I have no other income. None. We have donations, and those donations pay our basic bills. And I need to do more for my family. And so this is a way for me to do it. So if you've ever sent me a donation, I'm hoping that you'll think about buying this book and allow me to give you a gift back for all of your support these years. And if you haven't donated, I hope you'll look into being excited about this and wanting to take a peek and help me continue to support my family, and take this higher now. And thank you. Thank you very much for being here with me. I think that you'll find inside this book some sacred galactic scripture that maybe you've never heard of before. And it's very exciting. It's a lot of fun. I hope you enjoy it very much. So tonight, there is a lot to share. We're going to do a meditation later. I want to share with you a recording I have of President Obama's speech at the UK, where he addresses Parliament. And this is one of his most important speeches of his career. It's from today, and it's the only YouTube out there of the complete speech, and the quality is so-so. I'm hoping BBS Radio, the greatest radio station on the internet in the galaxy, can maybe clean it up a little, but it's so important, I'd like to share it with you. We will also have a teaching later on called The Mystery of Consciousness. And to begin with, I want to talk about the what's new around planet Earth. So, there was an article this week in BBC News, and it was about findings of new pyramids in Egypt. And we know that the pyramid system has to do with going to zero point. And this is a prerequisite of Nasara, everybody. So first let me read to you what Mark Huber had written about ZPM, zero point modules, so we can all understand what I'm talking about, why this article is timely and important. Ashtar and Saint Germain are orchestrating the ZPM amplification process, and they won't give us a date. We are certain only that we are in the final 10% of the energies of the equinox, and it is helping to define the interventional moment. ASTAR can retard or advance the ZPM amplification as he determines appropriate. There are different effects of the process, which will also make weapons non-functional. This ZPM amplification, everybody, is a kind of a force field, and Lord ASTAR is controlling it from the New Jerusalem, and he solely is, it's his job to be in control of it. So, Mark says, the Gulf of Aden Stargate and the ZPMs, quantum effects generators in the base of the ziggurats in the Mideast, are about to combine their effects to raise a shield around the planet and horizontally outwards that will render all weapons non-functional and to lead to a declaration of peace and the return of all troops to their homes. That will also fulfill the requirements for Nisara to be announced and implemented. Captain ASTAR and Admiral Sananda will determine the exact timing of those events. When weapons and aggression towards others will no longer be tolerated or functionally possible, due to the ZPMs reaching 100% of full power and the force field deployment that comes as part of that, the troops will come home. Already, all nuclear weapons on the planet have been made inert by the ASTAR command. All conflicts will cease to go forward. That includes Iraq, Afghanistan, Iran, Gaza, Israel, Africa, or any other place. When this happens, all the troops will come home and the assistance of the galactic ships overhead now. People are asking, what is happening with the ZPM's zero-point modules in the ziggurats in the Middle East? And this was dated a bit ago, and he says, the King of Egypt today reported that they are very close to or at 99.8%. You will recall that this is the percentage of full power they have to reach before ASTAR can turn a dial on the bridge of the New Jerusalem and take them up to 100%. This will generate the right and left arm overhead joining around the planet that will be an impenetrable electromagnetic light shield and also a horizontal force field in which combat will be impossible due to non-functioning weapons or allowance of aggressive actions. And you may recall that James Tiburon has brought through Metatron, and he has published information about this as well. He didn't call it ZPMs, but he talked about the force field that will be going around the Earth. Okay, so that gives you a little bit of background on why I feel this news from this week was important. This was dated May 24th. Two new finds are at Saqqara, an older but less known pyramid site than Giza. Saqqara is the Step Pyramid, and it's not a far drive, 20 minutes, I think, from the Great Pyramid. I was there, I'm not sure, I can't remember exactly, but I think it was 1988. I went there with my father. And it says, 17 lost pyramids are among the buildings identified in a new satellite survey of Egypt. Excuse me. Listen. You have to know that they've already done these scans long ago, and they've had this information a long time, but why are they telling us this week is what I'm interested in. More than 1,000 tombs and 3,000 ancient settlements were also revealed by looking at infrared images which show up underground buildings. Initial excavations have already confirmed some of the findings, including of two suspected pyramids. Wow. To excavate a pyramid is the dream of every archaeologist, says Dr. Sarah Parcock. She has pioneered the work in space archaeology from a NASA-sponsored laboratory in Birmingham, Alabama, and says she was amazed at how much she and her team have found. An infrared satellite image shows a buried pyramid located in the center of the highlighted box. You can look at this article on Galactic Roundtable, everybody, at the bottom of the page. There's a picture of the Step Pyramid on this article. We were very intensely doing this research for over a year. I could see the data as it was emerging. But for me, the aha moment was when I could step back and look at everything that we had found, and I couldn't believe we could locate so many sites all over Egypt. The team analyzed images from satellites orbiting 700 kilometers above the Earth. Equipped with cameras so powerful they can pinpoint objects less than 1 meter in diameter on the Earth's surface. Infrared imaging was used to highlight different materials under the surface. Ancient Egyptians built their houses and structures out of mud brick, which is much denser than soil that surrounds it, so the shapes of the houses, temples, and tombs can be seen. It just shows us how easy it is to underestimate both the size and scale of past human settlements, says Dr. Parkuk. And she believes there are more antiquities to be discovered. These are just the sites close to the surface. There are many thousands of additional sites that the Nile has covered over with silt. This is just the beginning of this kind of work. BBC cameras followed Dr. Parkuk on her nervous journey when she traveled to Egypt to see if excavations could back up what her technology could see under the surface. An infrared image shows a pattern of streets and houses in the buried ancient city of Tanis, T-A-N-I-S. In the BBC documentary, Egypt's Lost Cities, they visited an area of Saqqara where the authorities were not initially interested in her findings. But after being told by Dr. Parkuk that she had seen two potential pyramids, they made test excavations, and they now believe it is one of the most important archaeological sites in Egypt. But Dr. Parkuk said, the most exciting moment was visiting the excavations at Tanis. They've excavated a 3,000-year-old house that the satellite imagery had shown, and the outline of the structure matched the satellite imagery almost perfectly. That was real validation of the technology. Among other things, the Egyptian authorities plan to use the technology to help protect the country's antiquities in the future. During the recent revolution, looters accessed some well-known archaeological sites. We can tell from the imagery a tomb was looted from a particular period of time, and we can alert Interpol to watch out for antiquities from that time that may be offered for sale. She also hopes the new technology will help engage young people in science and will be a major help for archaeologists around the world. It allows us to be more focused and selective in the work we do. Faced with a massive site, you don't know where to start. It's an important tool to focus where we're excavating. It gives us a much bigger perspective on archaeological sites. We have to think bigger, and that's what satellites allow us to do. Indiana Jones is old school. We've moved on from Indy. Sorry, Harrison Ford. Cute article. Okay, so we know that there's pyramids that they have kept hidden all over the world, in the East and in South America especially. So I feel that these pyramids are coming out and they will be activated, and we'll be going to zero point anytime. So now what I'd like to do is share with you the president's speech from today. Here we go. Enjoy.
I have known few greater honors than the opportunity to address the Mother of Parliaments at Westminster Hall. I am told that the last three speakers here have been the Pope, Her Majesty the Queen, and Nelson Mandela, which is either a very high bar or the beginning of a very funny joke. I come here today to reaffirm one of the oldest, one of the strongest alliances the world has ever known. It's long been said that the United States and the United Kingdom share a special relationship. And since we also share an especially active press corps, that relationship is often analyzed and overanalyzed slightest hint of stress or strain. Of course, all relationships have their ups and downs. Admittedly, ours got off on the wrong foot with a small scrape about tea and taxes. There may also have been some hurt feelings when the White House was set on fire during the War of 1812. But fortunately, it's been smooth sailing ever since. And the reason for this close friendship doesn't just have to do with our shared history, our shared heritage, our ties of language and culture, or even the strong partnership between our governments. Our relationship is special because of the values and beliefs that have united our people through the ages. Centuries ago, when kings, emperors, and warlords reigned over much of the world, it was the English who first spelled out the rights and liberties of man in the Magna Carta. It was here, in this very hall, where the rule of law first developed, courts were established, disputes were settled, and citizens came to petition their leaders. Over time, the people of this nation waged a long and sometimes bloody struggle to expand and secure their freedom from the crown. Propelled by the ideals of the Enlightenment, they would ultimately forge an English Bill of Rights and invest the power to govern in an elected parliament that's gathered here today. What began on this island would inspire millions throughout the continent of Europe and across the world. But perhaps no one drew greater inspiration from these notions of freedom than your rabble-rousing colonists on the other side of the Atlantic. As Winston Churchill said, the Magna Carta, the Bill of Rights, habeas corpus, trial by jury, and English common law find their most famous expression in the American Declaration of Independence. For both of our nations, living up to the ideals enshrined in these founding documents has sometimes been difficult, has always been a work in progress. The path has never been perfect. But through the struggles of slaves and immigrants, women and ethnic minorities, former colonies and persecuted religions, we have learned better than most that the longing for freedom and human dignity is not English or American or Western. It is universal. And it beats in every heart. Perhaps that's why there are few nations that stand firmer, speak louder, and fight harder to defend democratic values around the world than the United States and the United Kingdom. We are the allies who landed at Omaha and Gold, who sacrificed side by side to free a continent from the march of tyranny, and help prosperity flourish from the ruins of war. And with the founding of NATO, a British idea, we joined a transatlantic alliance that has ensured our security for over half a century. Together with our allies, we forged a lasting peace from a Cold War. When the Iron Curtain lifted, we expanded our alliance to include the nations of Central and Eastern Europe, and built new bridges to Russia and the former states of the Soviet Union. And when there was strife in the Balkans, we worked together to keep the peace. Today, after a difficult decade that began with war and ended in recession, our nations have arrived at a pivotal moment once more. A global economy that once stood on the brink of depression is now stable and recovering. After years of conflict, the United States has removed 100,000 troops from Iraq. The United Kingdom has removed its forces, and our combat mission there has ended. In Afghanistan, we've broken the Taliban's momentum and will soon begin a transition to Afghan lead. And nearly 10 years after 9/11, we have disrupted terrorist networks and dealt al-Qaeda a huge blow by killing its leader, Osama bin Laden. Together, we have met great challenges. But as we enter this new chapter in our shared history, profound challenges stretch out before us. In a world where the prosperity of all nations is now inextricably linked, a new era of cooperation is required to ensure the growth and stability of the global economy. As new threats spread across borders and oceans, we must dismantle terrorist networks and stop the spread of nuclear weapons, confront climate change, and combat famine and disease. And as a revolution races through the streets of the Middle East and North Africa, the entire world has a stake in the aspirations of a generation that longs to determine its own destiny. These challenges come at a time when the international order has already been reshaped for a new century. Countries like China, India, and Brazil are growing by leaps and bounds. We should welcome this development, for it has lifted hundreds of millions from poverty around the globe and created new markets and opportunities for our own nations. And yet, as this rapid change has taken place, it's become fashionable in some quarters to question whether the rise of these nations will accompany the decline of American and European influence around the world. Perhaps the argument goes, these nations represent the future, and the time for our leadership has passed. That argument is wrong. The time for our leadership is now. It was the United States and the United Kingdom and our democratic allies that shaped a world in which new nations could emerge and individuals could thrive. And even as more nations take on the responsibilities of global leadership, our alliance will remain indispensable to the goal of a century that is more peaceful, more prosperous, and more just. At a time when threats and challenges require nations to work in concert with one another, we remain the greatest catalysts for global action. In an era defined by the rapid flow of commerce and information, it is our free market tradition, our openness, fortified by our commitment to basic security for our citizens, that offers the best chance of prosperity that is both strong and shared. As millions are still denied their basic human rights because of who they are or what they believe or the kind of government that they live under, we are the nations most willing to stand up for the values of tolerance and self-determination that lead to peace and dignity. Now, this doesn't mean we can afford to stand still. The nature of our leadership will need to change with the times. As I said the first time I came to London as president for the G20 summit, the days are gone when Roosevelt and Churchill could sit in a room and solve the world's problems over a glass of brandy. Although I'm sure that Prime Minister Cameron would agree that some days we could both use a stiff drink. In this century, our joint leadership will require building new partnerships, adapting to new circumstances, and remaking ourselves to meet the demands of a new era. That begins with our economic leadership. Adam Smith's central insight remains true today. There is no greater generator of wealth and innovation than a system of free enterprise that unleashes the full potential of individual men and women. That's what led to the Industrial Revolution that began in the factories of Manchester. That is what led to the dawn of the information age that arose from the office parks of Silicon Valley. That's that's why countries like China, India, and Brazil are growing so rapidly, because in fits and starts, they are moving toward market-based principles that the United States and the United Kingdom have always embraced. In other words, we live in a global economy that is largely of our own making. And today, the competition for the best jobs and industries favors countries that are free-thinking and forward-looking, countries with the most creative and innovative and entrepreneurial citizens. That gives nations like the United States and the United Kingdom an inherent advantage. For from Newton and Darwin to Edison and Einstein, from Alan Turing to Steve Jobs, we have led the world in our commitment to science, cutting-edge research, the discovery of new medicines and technologies. We educate our citizens and train our workers in the best colleges and universities on Earth. But to maintain this advantage in a world that's more competitive than ever, we will have to redouble our investments in science and engineering and renew our national commitments to educating our workforces. We've also been reminded in the last few years that markets can sometimes fail. In the last century, both our nations put in place regulatory frameworks to deal with such market failures. Safeguards to protect the banking system after the Great Depression, for example. Regulations that were established to prevent the pollution of our air and our water during the 1970s. But in today's economy, such threats of market failure can no longer be contained within the borders of any one country. Market failures can go global and go viral and demand international responses. A financial crisis that began on Wall Street infected nearly every continent, which is why we must keep working through forums like the G20 to put in place global rules of the road to prevent future excesses and abuse. No country can hide from the dangers of carbon pollution, which is why we must build on what was achieved in Copenhagen and Cancun to leave our children a planet that is safer and cleaner. Moreover, even when the free market works as it should, both our countries recognize that no matter how responsibly we live in our lives, hard times or bad luck, a crippling illness or a layoff may strike any one of us. And so part of our common tradition has expressed itself in a conviction that every citizen deserves a basic measure of security. Health care if you get sick, unemployment insurance if you lose your job, a dignified retirement after a lifetime of hard work. That commitment to our citizens has also been the reason for our leadership in the world. And now, having come through a terrible recession, our challenge is to meet these obligations while ensuring that we're not consuming, and hence consumed, with a level of debt that could sap the strength and vitality of our economies. And that will require difficult choices and will require different paths for both of our countries, but we have faced such challenges before and have always been able to balance the need for fiscal responsibility with the responsibilities we have to one another. And I believe we can do this again. As we do, the successes and failures of our own past can serve as an example for emerging economies, that it's possible to grow without polluting, that lasting prosperity comes not from what a nation consumes, but from what it produces and from the investments it makes in its people and its infrastructure. And just as we must lead on behalf of the prosperity of our citizens, so we must safeguard their security. Our two nations know what it is to confront evil in the world. Hitler's armies would not have stopped their killing had we not fought them on the beaches and on the landing grounds, in the fields and on the streets. We must never forget that there was nothing inevitable about our victory in that terrible war. It was won through the courage and character of our people. Precisely because we are willing to bear its burden, we know well the cost of war. And that is why we built an alliance that was strong enough to defend this continent while deterring our enemies. At its core, NATO is rooted in the simple concept of Article 5, that no NATO nation will have to fend on its own, that allies will stand by one another, always. And for six decades, NATO has been the most successful alliance in human history. Today, we confront a different enemy. Terrorists have taken the lives of our citizens in New York and in London. And while Al-Qaeda seeks a religious war with the West, we must remember that they have killed thousands of Muslims, men, women, and children around the globe. Our nations are not and will never be at war with Islam. Our fight is focused on defeating Al-Qaeda and its extremist allies. In that effort, we will not relent, as Osama bin Laden and his followers have learned. And as we fight an enemy that respects no law of war, we will continue to hold ourselves to a higher standard by living up to the values, the rule of law, and due process that we so ardently defend. For almost a decade, Afghanistan has been a central front of these efforts. Throughout those years, you, the British people, have been a stalwart ally, along with so many others who fight by our side. Together, let us pay tribute to all of our men and women who have served and sacrificed over the last several years. For they are part of an unbroken line of heroes who have borne the heaviest burden for the freedoms that we enjoy. Because of them, we have broken the Taliban's momentum. Because of them, we have built the capacity of Afghan security forces. And because of them, we are now preparing to turn a corner in Afghanistan by transitioning to Afghan lead. And during this transition, we will pursue a lasting peace with those who break free of Al-Qaeda and respect the Afghan constitution and lay down arms. And we will ensure that Afghanistan is never a safe haven for terror, but is instead a country that is strong, sovereign, and able to stand on its own two feet. Indeed, our efforts in this young century have led us to a new concept for NATO that will give us the capabilities needed to meet new threats. Threats like terrorism and piracy, cyber attacks and ballistic missiles. But a revitalized NATO will continue to hew to that original vision of its founders, allowing us to rally collective action for the defense of our people, while building upon the broader belief of Roosevelt and Churchill that all nations have both rights and responsibilities, and all nations share a common interest in an international architecture that maintains the peace. We also share a common interest in stopping the spread of nuclear weapons. Across the globe, nations are locking down nuclear material so they never fall into the wrong hands because of our leadership. From North Korea to Iran, we've sent a message that those who flaunt their obligations will face consequences, which is why America and the European Union just recently strengthened our sanctions on Iran. In large part because of the leadership of the United Kingdom and the United States. And while we hold others to account, we will meet our own obligations under the Non-Proliferation Treaty and strive for a world without nuclear weapons. We share a common interest in resolving conflicts that prolong human suffering and threaten to tear whole regions asunder. In Sudan, after years of war and thousands of deaths, we call on both North and South to pull back from the brink of violence and choose the path of peace. And in the Middle East, we stand united in our support for a secure Israel and
a sovereign Palestine. And we share a common interest in development that advances dignity and security. To succeed, we must cast aside the impulse to look at impoverished parts of the globe as a place for charity. Instead, we should empower the same forces that have allowed our own people to thrive. We should help the hungry to feed themselves, the doctors who care for the sick. We should support countries that confront corruption and allow their people to innovate. And we should advance the truth that nations prosper when they allow women and girls to reach their full potential. We do these things because we believe not simply in the rights of nations, we believe in the rights of citizens. That is the beacon that guided us through our fight against fascism and our twilight struggle against communism, and today that idea is being put to the test in the Middle East and North Africa. In country after country, people are mobilizing to free themselves from the grip of an iron fist. And while these movements for change are just 6 months old, we have seen them play out before. From Eastern Europe to the Americas, from South Africa to Southeast Asia. History tells us that democracy is not easy. It will be years before these revolutions reach their conclusion, and there will be difficult days along the way. Power rarely gives up without a fight, particularly in places where there are divisions of tribe and divisions of sect. We also know that populism can take dangerous turns, from the extremism of those who would use democracy to deny minority rights, to the nationalism that left so many scars on this continent in the 20th century. But make no mistake, what we saw, what we are seeing in Tehran, in Tunis, in Tahrir Square, is a longing for the same freedoms that we take for granted here at home. It was a rejection of the notion that people in certain parts of the world don't want to be free or need to have democracy imposed upon them. It was a rebuke to the worldview of Al-Qaeda, which smothers the rights of individuals and would thereby subject them to perpetual poverty and violence. Let there be no doubt, the United States and the United Kingdom stand squarely on the side of those who long to be free. And now we must show that we will back up those words with deeds. That means investing in the future of those nations that transition to democracy, starting with Tunisia and Egypt, by deepening ties of trade and commerce, by helping them demonstrate that freedom brings prosperity. And that means standing up for universal rights, by sanctioning those who pursue repression, strengthening civil society, supporting the rights of minorities. We do this knowing that the West must overcome suspicion and mistrust among many in the Middle East and North Africa. A mistrust that is rooted in a difficult past. For years, we face charges of hypocrisy from those who do not enjoy the freedoms that they hear us espouse. And so to them, we must squarely acknowledge that, yes, we have enduring interests in the region to fight terror, sometimes with partners who may not be perfect, to protect against disruptions of the world's energy supply. But we must also insist that we reject as false the choice between our interests and our ideals, between stability and democracy. For our idealism is rooted in the realities of history, that repression offers only the false promise of stability, that societies are more successful when their citizens are free, and that democracies are the closest allies we have. It is that truth that guides our action in Libya, it would have been easier at the outset of the crackdown in Libya to say that none of this was our business, that a nation's sovereignty is more important than the slaughter of civilians within its borders. That argument carries weight with some. But we are different. We embrace a broader responsibility. And while we cannot stop every injustice, there are circumstances that cut through our caution. When a leader is threatening to massacre his people, and the international community is calling for action. That's why we stopped the massacre in Libya. And we will not relent until the people of Libya are protected and the shadow of tyranny is lifted. We will proceed with humility and the knowledge that we cannot dictate every outcome abroad. Ultimately, freedom must be won by the people themselves, not imposed from without. But we can and must stand with those who so struggle. Because we have always believed that the future of our children and grandchildren will be better if other people's children and grandchildren are more prosperous and more free. From the beaches of Normandy to the Balkans to Benghazi. That is our interests and our ideals. And if we fail to meet that responsibility, who would take our place? And what kind of world would we pass on? Our action, our leadership, is essential to the cause of human dignity. And so we must act and lead with confidence in our ideals and an abiding faith in the character of our people who sent us all here today. For there is one final quality that I believe makes the United States and the United Kingdom indispensable to this moment in history. And that is how we define ourselves as nations. Unlike most countries in the world, we do not define citizenship based on race or ethnicity. Being American or British is not about belonging to a certain group. It's about believing in a certain set of ideals. The rights of individuals. The rule of law. That is why we hold incredible diversity within our borders. That's why there are people around the world right now who believe that if they come to America, if they come to New York, if they come to London, if they work hard, they can pledge allegiance to our flag and call themselves Americans. If they come to England, they can make a new life for themselves and can sing God Save the Queen just like any other citizen. Yes, our diversity can lead to tension. And throughout our history, there have been heated debates about immigration and assimilation in both of our countries. But even as these debates can be difficult, we fundamentally recognize that our patchwork heritage is an enormous strength. That in a world which will only grow smaller and more interconnected, the example of our two nations says it is possible for people to be united by their ideas instead of divided by their differences. It is possible for hearts to change and old hatreds to pass. It is possible for the sons and daughters of former colonies to sit here as members of this great parliament, and for the grandson of a Kenyan who served as a cook in the British Army to stand before you as President of the United States. is what defines us. That is why the young men and women in the streets of Damascus and Cairo still reach for the rights our citizens enjoy, even if they sometimes differ with our policies. As two of the most powerful nations in the history of the world, we must always remember that the true source of our influence hasn't just been the size of our economies, or the reach of our militaries, or the land that we've claimed. It has been the values that we must never waver in defending around the world. The idea that all beings are endowed by our Creator with certain rights that cannot be denied. That is what forged our bond in the fire of war. A bond made manifest by the friendship between two of our greatest leaders. Churchill and Roosevelt had their differences. They were keen observers of each other's blind spots and shortcomings, if not always their own. And they were hard-headed about their ability to remake the world. But what joined the fates of these two men at that particular moment in history was not simply a shared interest in victory on the battlefield. It was a shared belief in the ultimate triumph of human freedom and human dignity. A conviction that we have a say in how this story ends. This conviction lives on in their people today. The challenges we face are great. The work before us is hard. But we have come through a difficult decade, and whenever the tests and trials ahead may seem too big or too many, let us turn to their example. In the words that Churchill spoke on the day that Europe was free. In the long years to come, not only will the people of this island, but the world, wherever the bird of freedom chirps in the human heart, look back to what we've done, and they will say, do not despair, do not yield, march straight forward. With courage and purpose, with humility and with hope, with faith in the promise of tomorrow, let us march straight forward, together, enduring allies, in the cause of a world that is more peaceful, more prosperous, and more just. Thank you very much.
Wow, what a great speech. Thank you, everybody. I'm glad we listened to that together. I want to touch on two important stories that came out today briefly because there hasn't been a lot of news lately, and that's my posts slow down sometimes when there's not much news because I don't see a point of putting junk out there. And today there were two important pieces that came out that I wanted to share with you. You all remember who Elizabeth Warren is. She is the lady who is the professor, I forget if she's from Yale or Princeton. And President Obama has had her working with the Consumer Affairs Department, and she's reworking everything. And the whole point is that we don't want corporations to own our country, and we don't want them to buy our politicians. And if she's working for us, she will keep Wall Street out of our bank accounts. And so today I posted a letter, and you can sign the letter on galacticroundtable.com. And there's an article, and there's a picture, I forget what I put it with. It's right on the blog on the front of the round table tonight. And I'm going to read this letter to you, and you can see if you want to click on the links and sign it. President Obama appoint Elizabeth Warren to lead the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Republicans are threatening to block any appointment to lead the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Join top progressive voices on a letter urging President Obama to give a recess appointment to Elizabeth Warren. Add your name on the right. President Obama, Elizabeth Warren has proven that she is willing to stand up to Wall Street on behalf of consumers. Warren conceived the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau in response to the extraordinary abuses by Wall Street over the last decade that victimized consumers and nearly collapsed our economy. She has set up the new bureau with competence and dignity and is the single best choice to permanently lead it. When Republican senators threatened to oppose any consumer protection nomination unless the bureau was made less effective, Representative Barney Frank rightly called this the worst abuse of the confirmation process I've ever seen and added, what it clearly says is that the president will have to make a recess appointment. We agree. You did Americans proud by appointing Elizabeth Warren to set up this new Wall Street Accountability Bureau. Americans need her to lead it, and we urge you to give her a recess appointment. You can sign that letter. 69,567 people have signed it so far. And I remember I put a picture of President Obama and Elizabeth Warren walking in the White House together with roses. And that is the Kamala Rose, and Elizabeth Warren is all about reform. And if we want Nasara, we have to make these conscious choices. And if you don't know, a recess appointment is a presidential power that President Obama can use, and there won't have to be a vote if they want her or not. He'll just appoint her when they go home for summer vacation, and that'll be that, and she'll be in there. So I urge you to do some action politics there and let them know what your needs and what your wants are. Bernie Sanders has entered a new health care bill that I wanted to share with you, and this is fantastic. We had said earlier that everyone was disappointed because President Obama didn't get universal health care, you know, into law. And frankly, he almost didn't get the other health care bill passed into law as it was, the way it was. And I'm sure that he knew that he could come behind later. And he could, you know, add it afterwards. And this is what's happening now. So it was good that we passed it back then. And everybody can calm down when they're so ready to, you know, criticize the president for what he's doing. Because we all know that we've been trying to have a health care bill passed for 100 years, and nobody's been able to do it, but he was able to do it. And Barney Frank and Bernie Sanders were there when they were writing Nasara Law, and these are the ones that are still there, and they're fighting to get these things done. And so we need to support them. As many as 45,000 people in the U.S. die every year because they can't afford health care. And I'm not going to read the whole article, but I am going to skip down and read part of it to you, two paragraphs. Democratic politicians proudly point to the Patient Protection and Affordability Care Act, the bill that was signed by President Obama in March of 2010, as real progress. But Physicians for a National Health Program, an organization of doctors who support health care for all, say the bill is nothing more than a false promise of reform. Instead of eliminating the real problem, the new legislation will enrich and further entrench the private healthcare industry and leave 23 million people still uninsured, according to PNHP. Okay, that was the part we were not happy with, but that was okay because there were a lot of other provisions in that bill, in that law that passed, that have helped people immediately, and we've seen those examples out there. If Republicans have their way, the 45 million seniors and people with disabilities who rely on Medicare will see their out-of-pocket costs double or do without treatment altogether. I don't know about you, but I don't want Grandma being found down in her living room and nobody found her soon enough because we took away her Medicare. I think that's sickening. And they don't even mention people with disabilities, which is our vets and our children born with diseases who have disabilities from birth. Those people are, they'll be out of health care if the Republicans have their way. So Stan Brock doesn't like to talk about politics. He's too busy making sure people get treated. In this article, it talks about this guy and this business he has, and he has these free medical clinics. And he's saying that it's a shame that he's doing them in America because he's used to doing them in places like Bangladesh where they really need him. And there's a list of other countries he goes to, and he says, now I'm doing them in the United States, and it's kind of sad, and we need to change this. And he says, this is what happens when profit comes before care. United Health's first quarter profits for this year rose 13% to $1.35 billion with a B from $1.19 billion last year. United Health CEO Stephen Helmsley total compensation of $101.96 million. That was his paycheck for 1 year at work. I worked for United Health for 6 months on a contract. I have seen things you wouldn't want to see. And I know that it's the insurance companies who are paying off the politicians money under the table cash. I would say hundreds of thousands each to keep health insurance the way it is, because they're making billions and billions and billions and billions. And now we have to have free health clinics just to take care of Americans. And, you know, these ones that are paid off want to leave grandma by herself with no one to come help her, and she has no health insurance, so she just sits in her rocking chair year after year and doesn't go to the doctor, and the next year you know she's gone. Senator Bernie Sanders, an independent from Vermont who believes that the U.S. should put patients over profits, recently reintroduced the American Health Security Act, which would provide every citizen with health care coverage through a state administered single payer. Now get this, what does that mean? A state administered single payer. What it means is it's not a health care company, big rich fat cats administered. That's how they make their money, by administering it. We ask the states to administer it, and guess what? Streamlining payment through a single-payer system would save more than $400 billion per year. This is what the physicians want, because the insurance company require the physicians to sign their names to the treatments and the tests and everything that's done in the hospital, and they see the corruption. And the doctors want the single-payer system, and Bernie Sanders has reintroduced it. So get out there and get some action politics, because we need to take care of grandma and our vets and our babies who are born with diseases and they're disabled for life. Those parents should have some single payer backup, and we could spend that $400 million a year that we would save just in paperwork by taking it away from the insurance company. And this is an amazing thought, we could spend that money on sick kids instead. How about that? Okay, so I love those two news articles, and that will end the news. So, let's see. What do we want to do now? Oh, I think it's time for a song. Here we go.
Always had some.
Okay, so I want to do a meditation with you, and what it's going to be is a technique that the yogis use. It's one of the most basic techniques of breathing exercises there is out there, and everyone should know how to do this. And it's really cool. But first, I want to share with you this great article I found. When I was writing Sacred Galactic Scripture, I was researching all the religions, and I found this fantastic article that explains how Muhammad, when he was writing the Holy Quran, used the word Allah, and he meant it as mother, divine feminine mother, Mother Sekhmet. And the documentation is there, and I was so pleased to find this article that I wanted to share it with you. So let me read you this. It's called Islam and the Divine Feminine. There are so many things Westerners don't know, and so much damage was done since 9/11 to try to take control of our minds. And we're told such stupid things, and our instructions we receive in school don't do anything justice. And so then we end up with these programmed egos, and we don't know much. So I'm working very hard at helping us grasp the unity of totality and how much we're all the same, so that we break down these blocks and we can love each other more. So I hope you enjoy this article. Let me just take a sip. Islam and the Divine Feminine. So often has Islam been portrayed as an exclusively masculine, patriarchal faith that many have never suspected the central importance of the feminine in Islam and would be astonished to realize that it has been there from the beginning. I love this article, everybody, because we can see in the news, we can see in pictures and the articles that we read that there are, if you grow up in the Islam faith and your family is wealthy, you're going to go receive your lessons, your religious teaching, and you're going to understand everything I'm going to read in this article. But if you're a little girl growing up on a dusty street and you're not allowed to go to school, you're not going to get that your faith includes women, because the women are, you know, told to cover their bodies from head to toe, only have a little mesh over the eyes to peek out. Don't let us see you, and don't talk, and get in the kitchen. And that's what those little girls know, and that's what they're raised with. And that's not true in the affluent families, but it is true in some of the poorer families. And so if we Westerners don't know better, then how can we help those little girls? So that's why I love this article. Perhaps in part due to the metaphysical interiority of the feminine, this aspect of Islam has lived a largely hidden existence, but it is no less vital for that. In recent years, there has been much discussion and controversy over how to reshape Christianity to include the feminine on the divine level. But in Islam, that has never been an issue, for the feminine element in Islam has always been present, especially in Sufism. Although both masculine and feminine equally have their origin in the divine, I would like to take a special look at the feminine in Islam to help redress the balance between the feminine side of Islam has been mostly overlooked so far. Moreover, in the sources of Islam and in Sufi tradition growing there from there, we find a distinct, explicit preference for the feminine aspect of Allah, especially the nature of ultimate divine reality as essentially feminine, the polarity of divine majesty and beauty. The distinction between male and female, is not just a biological accident, but a very profound element of the human state. It goes back from the biological through the psychological and the spiritual to the divine reality itself. On the highest level of the divine reality, Allah is perfectly one. The root of duality between the masculine and feminine is found in the divine nature itself. Allah's essence transcends all duality, all relationality, so it is beyond male or female. But even on the level of the divine nature, there are the roots of the masculine and feminine. On the highest level, Allah is at once absolute and infinite. These two attributes are the supreme archetypes of the masculine and the feminine. Masculine and feminine are not simply equivalents of the human, male and female, since all men and women have elements of both masculinity and femininity within them. That Allah is absolute is the principle of masculinity, and that Allah is infinite is the principle of femininity. Allah has revealed himself in the Quran in the names of rigor and mercy, known as the names of majesty, Jalal, and beauty, Jamal. The generous, the merciful, the forgiving are names of mercy or beauty, while the enumerator and the just are names of rigor or majesty. On the level of the names are the principles of the masculine and the feminine. The names of majesty are the prototype of masculinity, while the names of beauty are the prototype of femininity. Vis-a-vis the world, Allah is the creator. This divine function is on the masculine side, representing the aspects of action, force, movement, rigor. Allah as lawgiver. But then there is the uncreating aspect of Allah. Allah is not exhausted by his creation of the world. Allah is more than the creator of the world. Al-Khaliq, the creator, is only one of the divine names. The divine reality did not completely participate in the act of creation. Allah is infinite and the world is finite. The non-creating aspect of Allah corresponds to the divine femininity. It is this to which Sufi poetry so often refers to the feminine. The images of the beautiful beloved are referring to the metacosmic aspect of the divine, not the creating aspect. That is why the Ibn al-Arabi says Allah can be referred to as both Huwa, he, and Hiya, she, feminine terms of divinity. Some of the key terms associated with the divine are in the feminine gender in Arabic. Three of them are essential to understand the feminine dimension in Islam. One of Allah's names is Al-Hakim, the wise. Wisdom is Hikmah. In Arabic, to say, for example, wisdom is precious, you could repeat the feminine pronoun Al-Hikmah Hiya Thamina. Literally, wisdom, she is precious. This has resonance with the forgotten Christian mystical tradition in which second term is Rama, mercy, related to the most important name of God after Allah, Al-Rahman, the all-merciful, related to the word womb, Rahim, the source of life. The source of life is the divine mercy, and the feminine aspect of it is very evident. The third, the most remarkable of all, is the word for the divine essence itself, Al-Dhat, which is also feminine, in that the divine essence is beyond being, unmanifest, and transcending all qualities. It may be understood as feminine. The renowned Sufi master Najm al-Din Kubra wrote of the Dhat as the mother of the divine attributes. According to a commentary on Ibn al-Arabi's Fusas al-Hikam, a hadith of Prophet Muhammad, gave priority to the true femininity that belongs to the essence. Ibn al-Arabi himself wrote that, I sometimes employ the feminine pronoun in addressing Allah, keeping in view the essence. On the metaphysical plane, femininity corresponds to interiority and masculinity to manifestation. In the traditional Islamic city, beauty is interiorized. All human beings contain both elements within themselves, in their souls and bodies and psyches. The perfection of the human state, all insan, all kamil, means the perfection of both masculine and feminine qualities together, the prototype of both male and female. In Sufism, men and women perform exactly the same rites and worship, so the perfection of human spirituality is equally accessible to men and women. Unlike in Theravada Buddhism, in which a woman must be reborn as a man to attain nirvana. Sufi literature has the greatest discussion of femininity in Islam. Sufi stories have transformed ordinary love stories into the most sublime levels of meaning. The love story of Layla and Majnun is the best known of all. It originates as a simple love story in Arabia, but Sufi literature elaborated it into the most beautiful love story ever put into Persian poetry. It symbolizes not only the love of man and woman in Allah, but the love of man for Allah. In these poems, the heroine is elevated to symbolize the divine reality itself. The divine reality is spoken of in terms of female beauty. The hero goes in quest of the divine, which is a masculine act. In contrast to Christian mysticism, in which God is actively masculine and the devotee is passively feminine, Sufi love stories depict the beloved as a woman who is a presence waiting in stillness while the hero is in quest for her. The name Layla comes from the word Layl, meaning night. Night represents the unmanifest. In the Arabian desert, the night is a reality without boundaries. Forms are dissolved. No sand dunes or camels or anything else visible. All is formless. Nothing but darkness. This is a direct symbolism of the unmanifested aspect of the divine nature, Allah, as unmanifest. Blackness absorbs all light, as it is above manifestation. So it symbolizes the beyond being. In the poem, Layla has named for the blackness of her hair and the beauty of the night. By extension, it in fact refers to the beauty of the divine reality beyond this world, beyond the act of creation, and therefore the supreme goal that the Sufi seeks to reach. The name of Majnun literally means crazy, but here it means someone not in an ordinary state of mind, symbolizing a person in quest of Allah. In this world in which most people forget Allah, the person who remembers him is considered crazy, as the male figure Majnun symbolizes the aspect of yearning and striving, going out in quest of Layla, while she is just sitting and combing her hair. The one who undertakes the journey, longing and crying for Layla, is the soul of the Sufi. Allah is the beloved in Sufi literature. The Mashuk is always depicted with female iconography. Although Islam is aniconic and does not make images of Allah, verbal depiction exists. Sufi literature is replete with this imagery of our experience of Allah as the vision of the beloved and union with the beloved. An elaborate vocabulary developed in which every part of woman's body, especially the face, symbolizes the divine reality. For example, the eyebrows are likened to a bow that shoots the arrow of the eye's glance, the arrow of love for Allah into our hearts, and makes us go beyond ourselves. Like the eyes of veiled women in traditional Islamic culture, where all you can see are their beautiful dark eyes. Their whole vocabulary of love has to be expressed through a single glance. The ruby red lips with their red color symbolize wine. Wine is used in Sufi literature to symbolize going beyond our ordinary consciousness into union with the divine. Although wine is forbidden in Islamic law, there will be pure wine to drink in paradise. Since Sufis experience paradise here in this world by having inner experience on the higher levels of reality, the wine of paradise is accessible symbolically through Sufism. Here, the redness of this wine is conjoined with the color of a woman's lips, At the same time, the kiss of the lips is an erotic symbol of union and intimacy. For example, Rumi said in the Masnavi, "Kings lick the earth, whereof the fair are made. For God hath mingled in the dusty earth a draught of beauty from his choicest cup. 'Tis that, fond lover, not these lips of clay, thou art kissing with a thousand ecstasies. Think, then, what it must be when undefiled." The vision of God in woman. There was a question long debated in Islam. Can we see Allah? The Prophet said in a hadith, "In paradise the faithful will see Allah with the clarity with that which you see the moon on the 14th night, the full moon." Theologians debated what this could mean, but the Sufis have held that you can see Allah even in the world through the eye of the heart. Al-Hallaj said in a poem, "Ra atu rabibi anye kalbi, I saw my Lord in the eye of my heart." The Sufis said that since you can have the experience of paradise even in this world, you can have the vision, ruya, of Allah. They have always described the theophantic experience as the vision of woman, the female figure as the object of ruya. The Tarjuman al-Ashwaq, Ibn al-Arabi's collection of love poems composed after meeting the learned and beautiful Persian woman Nizam in Mecca, is filled with images pointing to the divine feminine. The last chapter in his book, Fusus al-Hakim, relates that man's supreme witnessing of Allah in the form of woman during the act of sexual union. The contemplation of Allah in woman is the highest form of contemplation possible. As the divine reality is inaccessible in respect of the essence, and there is contemplation only in a substance, the contemplation of God in woman is the most intense and most perfect, and the union which is the most intense in the sensible order, for which serves as support for this contemplation, is the conjugal act. Allah as mother. In contrast to Christianity, Islam has never depicted God as father. Such a comparison is completely outside the boundaries of Islamic discourse. However, Muslims have always found it easy and natural to speak of maternal qualities of Allah. Prophet Muhammad was the first to use the example of mother to illustrate Allah's mercy. After a battle, the Prophet and his companions came upon a group of women and children. One woman had lost her child and was going around looking for him, her breasts flowing with milk. When she found her child, she joyfully put him to her breast and nursed him. The Prophet asked his companions, "Do you think that this woman could throw her son in the fire?" And they answered, "No." He then said, "Allah is more merciful to his servants than this woman to her son." From the Hadith collection of Al-Bukhari. Another Al-Bukhari Hadith describes how during the Muslim conquest of Mecca, a woman was running about in the hot sun searching for her child. She found him and clutched him to her breast, saying, "My son, my son." The Prophet's companions saw this and wept. The Prophet was delighted to see their mercy and said, "Do you wonder at this woman's mercy, Rama, for her child? By him in whose hand is my soul on the day of judgment, Allah shall show more Rama towards his believing servant than this woman has shown to her son." Now there, everybody, he is talking about Mother Sekhmet. Jalal al-Din Rumi, in an amazing passage of the Masnavi on the return to Allah, made reference to the story of the infant Moses and addressed Allah directly as mother. On resurrection day, the sun and moon are released from service, and the eye beholds the source of their radiance, and it discerns the permanent position from the lone, and this passing caravan from the abiding home. If for a while a wet nurse is needed, mother, return us to your breast. I don't want a nurse. My mother is more fair. I am like Moses, whose nurse and mother were the same. Masnavi 5701. that's absolutely talking about Mother Sekhmet. The Kaaba in Mecca, the very heart and pivot of the Islamic world, naturally is associated with the feminine imagery. You guys know the Kaaba in Mecca is that big black, you know, square. It's actually a stargate. And that's where all the people, you know, put on their white robes and they make their pilgrimage and they go there because it symbolizes Muhammad's last journey, because he traveled from the stargate at Mecca to the stargate in Jerusalem on his last journey. Back to the stars, to his home. The Kaaba in Mecca, the very heart and pivot of the Islamic world, naturally is associated with feminine imagery, veiled in the black color of the feminine beyond being. Medieval writers and poets have often compared the holiest shrine of Islam to a veiled bride or a desired virgin, especially when on the pilgrimage. Their goal was to touch and kiss her beauty mark, the black stone. Kakani was the Persian poet who most frequently employed the symbolism of his pilgrim poems. But another look at the Kaaba can come from the root of the name in an Arabic language. Although the word Kaaba itself means cube, it is very close to kub, meaning woman's breast. This turns out to be an appropriate metaphor, as indeed the Kaaba nurtures with the milk of spiritual blessings all the faithful who come and touch and kiss it. Consider also the eminently feminine Yani, form of the black stone setting. The Prophet's feminine soul. Prophet Muhammad's soul had a deeply feminine nature within. When his companions asked him whom he loved most in the world, he answered it was his wife, Aisha. They were surprised to hear him announce love for a woman, as this was a new concept to them. They had been thinking in terms of manly camaraderie between warriors. So they asked him which man he loved most, and he answered Abu Bakr, Aisha's father, a gentleman who was known for his sensitive personality. These answers confounded the companions, who until then had been brought up on a patriarchal values. The Prophet was introducing reverence for the feminine to them for the first time. Surah 109 in the Quran, Al-Kawathar, gives an especially revealing look into the Prophet's feminine soul. It was revealed because his energies had been taunting him that he had no sons, only daughters, while they had been given sons to perpetuate their patriarchal ways. Allah revealed his message of consolation to the Prophet. We have given thee Al-Kawathar. Surely the one who hates thee will be cut off from progeny. What is Al-Kawathar? A sacred pool of life-giving water in paradise, a profoundly feminine symbol. It represents a heavenly exaltation of the feminine over patriarchal society. The name of Kawthar is derived from the same root as Kathir, abundance, a quality of the supernal infinite, the divine feminine. Woman as creator. One of the most outright declarations of divine feminine in all Sufi literature is Rumi's Masnavi, in a passage praising the feminine qualities of kindness and gentleness, a passage that is increasingly well known in these days of the resurgent feminine. He says, "Woman is the radiance of God. She is not your beloved. She is the creator. You would say that she is not created." That's what I would say about Mother Sekhmet, right? The primacy of the feminine in Islam. Seen from the exterior, Islam may appear as a masculine-dominated faith. That is because of its external aspects, such as the sacred law that governs the social order, are a manifestation of Allah's Jalal attributes. The hidden side of Islam, little known to the outside world, lives and breathes the values of interiority, the loving, forgiving, merciful, divine presence of that draws hearts closer, the infinite Jamal aspects of Allah's beauty. The eternal primacy of Allah's feminine nature is established in a hadith Qudsi. My mercy precedes my wrath. Boy, that's what Mother Sekhmet says, isn't it? Beyond all the infinite, eternal mystery of all his uncreated essence is the divine feminine, and that is the ultimate spiritual reality, calling to the souls who love Allah to come home and find perfect peace. Wow, love that article. Thank you. Now, I would like us to meditate. I want to introduce you to this technique of bringing energy into your body, storing energy so you can use more energy to share with others. And this man who's teaching this lesson of this meditation is a yogi, and he might have a little bit of an accent, so just close your eyes and relax and enjoy, and you'll get what he's saying because he repeats himself. This is a technique and a meditation, and he's teaching you how to do this. And if you can get this and integrate it into your life, it is one of the most important techniques you're going to learn in this lifetime. So enjoy. Thank you.
Breathe inside. Close the right nostril, spinal cord straight. Eyes closed and you feeling calm. Close right nostril with the thumb and left nostril with the two middle fingers. Sit straight, easy eyes, calm interior, completely composed and with complete surrender. Now do it on the other side. Inhale deeply from the left side. And now exhale from the right. Now inhale from the right. In this way, keep on doing it. Inhale from the left, exhale from the right. Inhale from the right, exhale from the left. This is Anulom Vilom Pranayam. Inhaling in the lungs deeply and then exhaling. Remember that you have to inhale deeply up to the diaphragm and then exhale deeply in a sequence, in a rhythm. Maintain this sequence, first Bhastrika Pranayam, then Kapalabhati, and then Bahya. Thereafter, Anulom Vilom Pranayam. Kapalabhati activates pancreas. Very often we find that...
Okay, everybody, so if you didn't get what he said, don't worry. So you're going to take two fingers and plug one of your nostrils. Breathe in through the open nostril. And then take two fingers or your thumb or whatever you want and close the nostril that you weren't using. And then exhale with the, you know, with the open nostril. Then inhale again on that side. Then close that nostril and exhale on the other side. Close your eyes and keep doing that while he's talking. You'll really enjoy this.
Diabetes and kidney problems are discovered when 80% of beta cells of pancreas have stopped working, and when kidney is damaged by 80%, then we discover the damage. Both of these problems can be taken care of by these pranayama practices. So we can say that by practicing Kapalabhati pranayama, one can actually rejuvenate one's kidney as well as one's pancreas. We know that diabetes causes so many problems. For example, hypertension causes gangrene. It affects blood circulation. It also weakens your eyesight and the performance of the heart. But we must not forget that all these diseases and all problems can be very well managed, treated, treated and overcome permanently with the help of this wonderful and effective pranayam called Anulom Vilom Pranayam. This wonderful pranayam also proves very effective in the cases of heart troubles. The heart gets weakened and doesn't perform to its full level, or one misses pulses. For hypertension too, Anulom Vilom proves to be a perfect pill. One would feel as if one has got a new heart installed. This wonderful pranayam also proves very effective in the cases of hypertension, depression, a deep feeling of insecurity, a fear, a tension, a stress always surrounds the heart and mind of man. In today's society, everybody is so frightened. So much insecurity inside every man. Everybody feels very lonely at heart. Just do Anulom Vilom with complete devotion and you will find Paramatma, the Almighty God, is around you every moment. And that is why you never feel insecure or unhappy. But instead, every moment you have this feeling of God inside you. The world may leave you in lurch. The same world that you have been nurturing all your life. You are standing alone. But God will never leave you in the midway. You must experience the lap of that Parampita Parameshwar, the Almighty God, the Heavenly Father. So keep doing pranayam and keep meeting that big, the mighty, the true master of this universe. With Tadamya Bhav, join yourself with the Father of the universe. Turn towards your Father, Father of the universe, your true house, that root that remains the same. Life after life, that loving mother of the universe. Prana Brahma, Prana Vasu, Prana Rudra, Prana Aditya. The most living of all the living beings. Prana Mata, Prana Brata, Prana Sakha, Prana Acharya, Prana Brahma. These all purify your behavior. They make you an optimist, for pessimism is what is breaking the people of today. Obviously, society is getting broken down. Things are getting totally disintegrated. Anulom Vilom Pranayam would make your vision of life totally positive. It would turn the life into a celebration. Breathe becomes aromatic. Your life would become a swirl, very pleasing, very relaxing. Now, after doing this pranayam, please stop for some time. And in this way, you must keep on doing this Anulom Vilom pranayam for at least 15 days. And then slowly increase the exercise, and very soon you will find that benefits of Anulom Vilom, it will help recuperate the nervous system. Your heart will become completely fit. All the troubles of mind would simply go away. It can even take off diseases like Parkinsonism. It definitely takes little time, but it's an amazing treatment. Now even polio patients are getting recovered. Polio patients, even paralysis can be cured by this pranayam. Brain tumor is getting treated. Cancer is getting treated. Anywhere in the body, for that, one should do this Kapalbhati pranayam for at least 10 to 15 minutes daily. Asthma, bronchitis, sinusitis, all these problems are getting cured. Even the chronic, the most chronic arthritis, all of them can be cured with Anulom Vilom Pranayam. And with Kapalbhati Pranayam, one can cure filarial, which is normally incurable. That also can be taken care by doing both Kapalbhati and Anulom Vilom Pranayam. Both these pranayams have a connection. Thank you. Breathe inside deeply and exhale. All these pranayama, even pregnant mothers and sisters should do, excepting Kapalabhati Bahya Pranayama. But they have to be done with ease. There would be no case of disabled childbirth. There would be no hole in the child's heart. No child would be born with diabetes or any other ailment. It also has specific benefit. It takes care of the problem of multi-conceptions. It's even being experimented on Mongol children that they too are getting benefited. It's amazing pranayama. A life is attained and the old body is gotten rid of. For the transformation, you just remain focused and just destroy your wrong present and get birth in a new form. A totally new shape, a new life. Get a new focus. Because for transformation, you don't need time. All you need is just your total dedication to this pranayama with complete devotion. Seek.
Okay, that's pretty interesting, I think. Let's have another song, everybody, okay? Boy, I feel great from that breathing. Okay, just to give you an idea, I've been so completely immersed in the world religions lately, writing this book, Sacred Galactic Scripture. I have covered Taoism, Judaism, Hinduism, Christianity, Sufism, Islamism, did I say Buddhism, and sometimes there's more than one of those. My guides took me into these ancient texts and showed me and said, look here, look what's written here, look at the beauty, look at the unity, tell people about this. The whole reason for the book is that by reading any of these ancient texts, of which every word of all of them is included in the book, reading any of them will unlock coded formulas in your heart and in your mind. And your local mind will be able to connect with cosmic mind, divine mind. And you will remember your galactic heritage, and you will come closer to enlightenment just by reading it. I have been on this amazing path, rediscovering these galactic truths, and I know you're really going to enjoy it. And this article I shared with you about divine feminine and Islamism is only just a small example of the kind of discussion that's in there. And the deeper I delved, the more I found out that they were all saying the same thing, because every single one of them is about how we came to come to Earth, why we came to come to Earth, and what it will take for us to come into our enlightenment. It's beautiful. I had so much pleasure doing it. So now I would like to share with you a teaching from Deepak Chopra called The Mystery of Consciousness. This sacred galactic scripture, in researching it, I was reading about obtaining higher consciousness every day. So I thought this would be a wonderful thing to share tonight. Enjoy.
We're doing a lot of meditation, and you'll be learning certain advanced techniques in meditation called Sutra meditation. And in between, I'll try and explain things to you theoretically. Okay. So, let me ask you a question. Since you're here for a course called The Seduction of Spirit, what's your understanding of the word spirit? Yeah, anyone? Consciousness. Who said that? Okay. So, yeah, we use the word spirit synonymously with the word consciousness. We're all conscious beings. Hopefully everybody is conscious at this moment. Okay? So, consciousness, or being alive, or what is called sentience, is the same thing as spirit. Without consciousness, there's no life. Life and consciousness are synonymous. It is because of consciousness that we have any experience whatsoever. So, if you don't have consciousness, you can't see. If you don't have consciousness, then you can't hear, taste, or smell. All perception is based on consciousness. But not only is perception, which means what we see as the outside world, based on consciousness, but all what's happening inside us is also dependent on consciousness. So without consciousness, you can't think. You can't imagine. you can't remember all our internal experiences, memories, desires, emotions. They're dependent on consciousness. Our behavior is dependent on consciousness. Our personal relationships depend on consciousness. Our social interactions depend on consciousness. Our connection to the what we call the environment. And hopefully by the end of this week you'll realize that there's no such thing as the environment. But for now, our interaction with what we call the environment is dependent on consciousness. There's forces are an expression of consciousness. So in the great tradition of Vedanta, there's a saying. And the saying is, if you can see it, if you can touch it, if you can taste it, if you can smell it, if you can imagine it, if you can conceptualize it, if you can visualize it, if you can think about it, then it's not real. Okay? It's an impermanent projection of something that you cannot see, something that you cannot smell, taste, or even conceptualize or imagine. And what is that? It's consciousness. That's real. You cannot conceptualize it, but without it, there would be no conception. You cannot imagine it, but without it, there would be no imagination. You cannot see it, but without it, there would be no sight. You cannot hear it, but without it, there would be no hearing. So what is more real? The impermanent projection that you can see or hear or touch or taste or smell or imagine, or that which cannot be imagined, which cannot be seen, which cannot be conceptualized, but without which nothing is possible. So again, in this great tradition of Vedanta, there's a saying, know that one thing by knowing which everything else is known. It's the highest form of knowledge. You know, the word Vedanta means the end of all knowing. Veda means to know. It's the same as the English word, word. Veda, word, the German word, Wort. Now, this is a very interesting word because it's also the origin of the word Druid, the Druid priest, Druvid. So, to Veda means to know. Vedanta means the end of all knowing. Because once you know consciousness, then you realize that based on that, everything else can be known. Everything else can be known. So it's the highest form of knowledge. Okay, so let's do a little exercise right now to give you a little bit of inkling what we are talking about and where we're going to go with this week. So close your eyes and imagine that you're looking at a beautiful sunset on the ocean. Now let it go. Imagine that you're looking at a full moon and a starlit night sky. Let it go. Imagine that you're looking at a golden flame of a candle in a dark room. Let it go. Imagine that you're looking at the golf course that is somewhere here on the grounds. Imagine that you're looking at the face of someone you love. Okay, so we saw some sights. Now let us keep our eyes closed and hear some sounds. Imagine that you're listening to a newborn baby crying. Imagine that you're listening to a dog barking in the middle of the night. Imagine that you're listening to the voice of someone you love. Now let's try some textures that we can feel. Imagine that your hands are touching the rough bark of a tree. Feel the sensation. Imagine that you're touching the soft petals of a rose. Imagine that you're touching the skin of a newborn baby. Feel the sensation. So, we saw some pictures, we heard some sounds, we felt some textures. Now let's imagine some tastes. Imagine that you're tasting strawberries. Imagine that you're tasting coffee. Imagine the taste of licking a lemon. Now let's try some smells. Imagine that you're smelling Chinese food or an Italian kitchen or the locker room in your gym. Okay, now please open your eyes. So, just now, I made some suggestions, okay? I just made some suggestions, and you had a subtle intention. A subtle intention means a very faint intention. And that faint intention was in your consciousness. As a result of that faint intention, subtle intention, you had an experience. So, and where was that experience? Also in your consciousness, right? Now, imagine that I have the technology to look inside your brain, which these days we have. So these days we can take a carbon atom, we can radio label it, we can put it in a sugar molecule, and then we can inject it into the bloodstream, and then we can take what are called positron emission tomography pictures of the brain. Or there are other techniques called magnetic resonance imaging. Okay. So there are different types of scanning techniques, and one can look inside the brain when you have those experiences. Okay. So a few minutes ago, I said, imagine a beautiful sunset on the ocean or a golden flame in a dark room. You saw a picture, right? Everybody saw a picture? But was there a picture in your brain? What was in your brain? In your brain, there was mainly electrical and chemical activity. Electrical and chemical activity, and this is activity between the connections of your neurons. Between neurons, there are certain, you can think of these very micro, nano cables. You might think of them as little cable channels, and along them, there were electrical currents going. And at the end of the electric, where the neurons meet or are supposed to meet, there's a little gap. It's called a synapse. Over there, there's the release of chemicals. So when someone looks inside your brain, there's electrical activity or electromagnetic activity. Same thing. Like whenever you have electricity, you also have a magnetic field perpendicular to it. And then there's a discharge of a chemical. Various kinds of chemicals, but predominantly two between synapses. They're called gamma-aminobutyric acid and something called glutamate. So one stimulates, the other depresses. And the electrical activity is also because of an electrical action potential, which is the exchange of ions across cell membranes. So in your brain, there is no picture. The picture that you just saw of the sunset or the golden flame or the golf course was in your consciousness. And of course, the question is, did the electricity in your brain produce the picture in your consciousness? Or did the picture in your consciousness produce the electricity in your brain? Or did you, now we come to who that you is, through subtle intention produce both at the same time? That you actually produced both the electricity and the picture. The picture in your consciousness and the electricity in your brain. Did you do that? I think intuitively you recognize you did it. You had an intention, then you saw a picture. And I say picture, you heard a sound. You tasted strawberries in your consciousness. Okay, you heard sounds, you tasted strawberries, you had experiences of texture, smell, etc. in your consciousness. And intuitively, if you feel that both things happened at the same time, the electricity in your brain and the experience in your consciousness. What's the connection between the two? Not clear. There is obviously a connection, right? But, you know, there are certain mysteries in science to which only one famous expression can be applied. Somebody, a great scientist, Sir Arthur Eddington, he once said, something unknown is doing we don't know what. Okay. We can say the same thing of this case. So right now you had an experience in consciousness. We can say it was an experience in your imagination. And it was an experience in consciousness. And it was orchestrated through subtle intention. Subtle intention means faint. Because when I said, look at a sunset, you didn't say to yourself, how do I look at a sunset? Okay, you just had a faint intention. You didn't ask yourself, how do I create the picture of a sunset? You just did it with a faint intention. Okay, now let's take something else. Somebody want to tell me what color this is? Orange. Is there an orange beam of light coming from here to your eyes? No, right? Otherwise we'd see orange beams. What's coming from here to your eyes is an invisible electromagnetic disturbance. Okay, electromagnetic means, again, electricity, magnetism, basically photons. Photons, electromagnetic fields are called virtual photons. Photons are the carriers of the smallest units of energy in the whole universe. Okay. So a photon is the smallest unit of energy and also of information in the whole universe. So some invisible electromagnetic energy is coming from here to your eyes. But what's coming from here to your eyes doesn't have orange color. Clear? It stimulates your eyes. It causes a chemical reaction. And the retina, and from there an electrical current goes to your brain. And I think you would agree that the electrical current that goes from your eyes to your brain is not orange in color. It's just an electrical current. Once it gets to your brain, again, same synaptic nerves, you know, there are synaptic firings, which means electrochemical activity between neurons. Think of these as little fiber optic channels, cables between your neurons, and that electrochemical activity with the same two chemicals. And then, where is the orange? Where's the orange produced? Okay, in your consciousness. So is orange the color of this flower, or is orange an activity in your consciousness? Orange is an activity in your consciousness. What's over here? Well, if you really want to get down to it, this is made up of molecules, and the molecules are made up of atoms, and the atoms are made up of subatomic particles, and these subatomic particles are fluctuations of energy and information in a huge emptiness. There's no color out here. In fact, one of the greatest scientists who actually was responsible for describing synaptic firings, you know, amongst others, Sir John Eccles. He was an Australian. He won the Nobel Prize in physics, and I think in neuroscience, I forget now, but he was a Nobel laureate. And he said, there are no colors in the real world. There are no textures in the real world. There's no beauty, no ugliness, nothing of the sort. And now I'm paraphrasing. What really exists is a radically ambiguous and ceaselessly flowing quantum soup, which means energy that's vibrating. And the color is an activity of your consciousness, not an activity of your brain, because whether you're imagining something or whether you're seeing something, in your brain, the activity is the same. In your brain, the activity is exactly the same, whether you're imagining it or seeing it. And so the experience of color is in your consciousness. Okay? Now, of course, you're also listening to my voice. I'm vibrating my vocal cords, right? Does the vibration of my vocal cords produce sound? Yes or no? No, it doesn't. When vocal cords vibrate, they vibrate. And there is some air in my voice box, in my windpipe, and the air in my windpipe starts to vibrate. That causes the vibration of this atmosphere. The vibration of the atmosphere makes no noise. That causes the vibration of your eardrums, and there inside your ears there are certain hairs. They're called cilia, which is another term for hairs, very fine hairs, and they start to move, and that creates an electrical current to your brain. The electrical current that goes to your brain makes no sound. So, where's the sound? It's in your consciousness. Is it in your brain? No. Is it in your nerves? No. Is it in your eardrums? No. Is it in this atmosphere? No. Am I making it? No. The sound that you're hearing is an activity of your consciousness. Are you getting this? Okay? So, this color is in your consciousness. The sound that you're hearing is in your consciousness. What's in the universe is just vibrations, period. And most of the vibrations at the most fundamental levels are electromagnetic vibrations. Okay. In the universe, just vibration, energy vibrating at different frequencies. In your nervous system, energy vibrating. In fact, your nervous system is also energy vibrating. Because it's made up of the same stuff. Your nervous system is made up of molecules, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, which are made up of the same stuff as this flower, the same stuff as this chair. Everything is a vibration of energy. Everything. But color is in your consciousness. Sound is in your consciousness. Texture is in your consciousness. Taste is in your consciousness. Smell is in your consciousness. But when you close your eyes and experience color, taste, and smell, you call it imagination. When you open your eyes and you have the same experience, you call it the real world. What we call the real world is actually a experience in consciousness of color, form, taste, texture, smell. It's all inside our consciousness, the whole thing. Whether we call it imagination or memory or the real world. And there is no inside or outside. Because it's all in your consciousness. There's a beautiful poem of Rumi where he says, I've lived on the lip of insanity, wanting to know reasons, knocking at the door opens, I've been knocking from the inside. There is no outside. It's all contained in your consciousness. So the essential nature, and I'm simplifying this because it can get complicated, but I'm simplifying this. Whether you experience sound, touch, sight, taste, or smell, it's all happening in your consciousness. It's all the translation of vibrations. This vibration, very, very frequently when scientists talk about this vibration, they call it discontinuity. Discontinuity because something that goes on and off. Okay. Our experience of continuity is in consciousness when the universe is actually one of discontinuity, which means vibrations going on and off. And this is true of all experience, whether it's sound, touch, sight, taste, or smell. It's all based on discontinuity. Okay, so if I put my hand on your thigh and I don't move it, then after a while you won't know it's there. But then if I start to move it again, you might say, what the heck are you trying to do? There is no experience in the absence of vibration. But we don't experience the world as vibrations. We experience the world as color, as form, as sound, as taste, as smell, which are activities in our own self. Okay? So far, clear? So if you really understood, then answer the following question. Where is Deepak right now? In your consciousness. Okay, where is this microphone now? Where is your own body? Where are your thoughts? Okay, it's all inside you. So here's the first principle. You are not in your body. Your body is in you. You are not in your mind. Your mind is in you. And you're not in the world is in you. There's a very famous line, by the way, in the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna explaining yoga to the great warrior Arjuna, and he says in Sanskrit, Prakratim Swam Vashtabhai Vishrajami Punapuna. Curving back within myself, I create again and again. I curve back within myself, I create the mind. I curve back within myself, I create the body. I curve back within myself and create the whole universe. So, it seems like we've got it upside down because we say, you know, my soul is in my body is in the world. It's the other way around. The world and the body are in your soul. If by soul we mean the core consciousness in which all experience occurs. Now, we cannot deny that we have consciousness. You know, you can deny everything else, but you can't deny the fact that you're conscious. It's the feeling of being alive. It's the feeling of having experience. Okay, so we've established some very important points right now. That the world exists in your consciousness, the body exists in your consciousness, and the mind exists in your consciousness. These are all activities of yourself in yourself. Agreed? Okay. Now let's go a little more into this. Everybody says, okay, now I agree that you know everything's happening in consciousness. Where the heck is it? If I go inside your brain, will I find you there? And the answer is, I won't find you there. If I go inside your body, will I find you there? I won't find you there. People have done all kinds of experiments. And in fact, the best scientists cannot locate consciousness. They cannot find you in your body. And of course, there's a very simple, hypothesis in science, it's called, or principle I should say in science, it's called Occam's principle. Occam's principle, named after a scientist called Occam, and says when you don't have an explanation for something, then the simplest explanation is probably the best explanation. So what would be the simplest explanation? That you can't be found in your body? You're not there. Okay. You're not in your body. Of course, we said that. The body is in you. You're not in the world. The world is in you. You're not in the mind. The mind is in you. Still doesn't help too much. You say, but I want to know this person. You know, after all, okay, I agree, I'm not in the body, I'm not in the mind, I'm not in the world, but then where am I? And science has been unable, as I said. And there are some great scientists today, some great scientist philosophers, who say when you can't find it, you know, it's probably consciousness doesn't exist. That it is not, it's something that's a hallucination. It probably doesn't exist. There's a scientist called Daniel Dennett who's very famous. They deny the existence of consciousness. Okay, but can you deny that you don't exist? It's the one thing that you can be sure of, that you exist. So here is something which is a little controversial, but more and more scientists gradually are coming to this understanding that consciousness is in the discontinuity. That means it's in between the vibrations. In between the vibrations. The vibration itself is energy, information. And this is something that is part of our technology today. When you send somebody the nature of the material world, is not, that it's not material. That the essential nature of the physical world is that it's not physical. It's vibration. So, we know that the vibration has energy and information, but what's in between the vibration? What's in the discontinuity? And a number of people are beginning to understand that discontinuity may be consciousness itself. Okay. Here are five things you can remember about discontinuity. Number one, when we look inside the discontinuity, there is no energy there, there's no information there. There is no space-time there, and there are no objects there. No energy, no information, no space-time, and no objects. So what's there? And the best answer science can give us is there are infinite possibilities. That the discontinuity or consciousness is a field of infinite possibilities. It's the immeasurable potential for all that was, and all that is, and all that can be. It's the potential for space-time, energy, information, and objects. So, consciousness is not in space-time. Consciousness is not in space-time. It's where the experience of space and time happens. Where are you experiencing space right now? Right? You see, you're looking at me, okay, and you say there is some space here. But you can't see space, right? Space is not a sensory experience. You can see the objects, you can't see space. Space is created in your consciousness. Where is time created? In your consciousness. But your consciousness is not in space-time. Your consciousness is spaceless, which means it doesn't occupy space. It's timeless, which means it has no location in time. So when you say, I'm looking for consciousness, you're looking in the wrong place. Because consciousness does not occupy space. Consciousness does not exist in time. It's timeless. You, who is consciousness, is spaceless and timeless and dimensionless, and without you, the spaceless, dimensionless consciousness, there is no space-time. There are no objects, there's no energy, there's no information. Again, teaching of the Bhagavad Gita, when Lord Krishna describes this to Arjuna, he says, water cannot wet it, wind cannot dry it, weapons cannot shatter it, fire cannot burn it, It has no beginning in time, it has no ending in time. And therefore it cannot die. Because only that which began ends. But that which never began has no ending. Okay, spaceless, timeless, dimensionless, but without which no space, no time, no dimensions whatsoever. So that's the first thing to recognize, that consciousness is a field of possibilities, and you, that field of possibilities, do not exist in space or time. So stop looking for consciousness in space-time. The reason you're here is you're here to get in touch with consciousness. And when you get in touch with consciousness, is who's getting in touch with consciousness? Your consciousness is getting in touch with consciousness. So when consciousness is looking for consciousness, that by definition is a subjective experience. Any objective evidence of consciousness by examining the brain or doing PET scans or MRIs, any objective evidence of consciousness is at best inferential. Inferential means indirect. Science will never be able to find consciousness objectively. It can only infer circumstantially. You know, I recently gave a talk in LA, and one of the people who attended the talk was a famous lawyer called Gloria Allred. You probably heard of her. And I said to her, you know, consciousness, the evidence for consciousness objectively would never be admitted in court. Okay, because it's circumstantial evidence. Okay, the only direct evidence is you. You exploring consciousness subjectively, which is what we're going to do here. Okay, so the first attribute of consciousness, infinite possibilities. The generator of space-time, energy, information and matter. But not existing in space-time. You know, when there was, I don't know if you read the debate between between Richard Dawkins, who's the most important, let's say, most well-known atheist of our time, and Francis Collins. Francis Collins is the head of the Genome Project, and he's a Christian, observing Christian. He believes in God, and Dawkins, of course, does not believe in God, because the God he's trying to attack actually doesn't exist. But one of the things in that debate was Francis Collins does say to Dawkins, the reason you can't find God is you're looking in the wrong place. You're looking in space-time when God exists outside of space-time. God is the creator of space-time. And so too you, your consciousness, which is part of that infinite consciousness, exists outside of space-time. Okay, so that's the first attribute of consciousness. The second is it's a field of non-local correlation. Non-local correlation means everything in the whole universe is correlated with everything else in the whole universe instantly, faster than the speed of time. Everything is entangled with everything. Everything is in harmony with everything. And actually, when you look at biological organisms and activity in nature, things don't happen one at a time. Things all happen all at the same time. A human body, for example, has 100 trillion cells, which is more than all the stars in the Milky Way galaxy. Each cell in your body can do 100,000 activities per second, and every cell instantly correlates its activity with every other cell. How can a human body think thoughts, play a piano, kill germs, remove toxins, and make a baby all at the same time? And while your body can do that, it tracks the movement of stars and planets, because your body is a symphony of the whole universe. The whole universe. That's why we call the universe the universe. One song, one symphony. And your body is a symphony, but so is this. Right? So is this. This is everything coming together. Rainbows and sunshine and earth and water and wind and air and the infinite void. And the whole universe's history is contained in this flower. Okay, this is also a symphony of the whole universe. And this and you and the whole universe are instantly correlated, which means it's one harmonic expression of consciousness. You know, non-local correlation or entanglement or quantum mechanical interrelatedness. You know, some people say acausal non-local quantum mechanical interrelatedness. There's mathematical terms for describing, I would say, for describing omniscience, omnipresence, omnipotence. Everything past, present, and future, and everything across space-time instantly correlated. Past, present, and future also, because distance in space is also distance in time. Second principle. Consciousness, therefore, first is infinite possibilities. Second is omnipresence, omniscience, omnipotence, which means you know everything you need to know. If you know your consciousness, then you know everything. Which doesn't mean you're like Wikipedia. Okay? It means you have an intuitive knowledge of whatever you need to know when you need to know it. If you're in touch with your consciousness. It also means you have infinite imagination and other things. But you know everything. At the deepest part of yourself, you know everything. You don't have to learn anything. The third attribute of consciousness is that it proliferates in uncertainty. It's a realm of uncertainty, of unpredictability. We don't need to go into the history of it, but basically, there's a level of nature where the laws of nature preclude you from understanding the laws of nature fully. They become uncertain, which is very annoying to scientists because science is based on certainty. If, you know, if the laws of nature were not 100% predictable, we wouldn't be able to do science. But at the most fundamental levels, it's unpredictable. Famous expression of Einstein, God does not play dice with the universe. Famous expression of Stephen Hawking, God not only plays dice with the universe, he throws the dice where you will not find it. Okay, but actually Einstein had another expression. He said, and I'm paraphrasing, insofar as the laws of nature are real, they are not certain. Insofar as they are certain, they are not real. Okay, there's a level of nature where there is unpredictability. And thank God for that, because if there was no uncertainty, there would be no creativity. A system that is closed and certain is a fixed system. There's no creativity. Which leads us to the fourth property of consciousness, leaps of creativity, quantum leaps of creativity. Quantum leaps of creativity, which means when you leap from one space-time event into a new space-time event, there's no direct algorithmic relationship between the previous and the next manifestation. If you watch the program Star Trek, when the captain says, beam me up, Scotty. Okay, Scotty disappears here, shows up somewhere else. Or when they say, jump into another dimension. Okay, your imagination is like that. You leap in imagination. I say, okay, think of where you are right now, and then think of New York. You don't have to go from here to New York. You take a quantum leap. Or think of your childhood, you took a quantum leap. Or think of when you fell in love. There's no relationship between looking at this flower and saying, think of your teenage years. But you can jump from here to there without going through the space in between, in either space or time. So let's say the fourth expression of consciousness is quantum creativity, which is infinite. Infinite creativity. And finally, the fifth expression of consciousness, which is called observer effect, which was described by a great scientist called John Wheeler and others, who basically said that the physical universe does not exist unless there's a conscious being looking at it. There were no conscious beings looking at the universe, it would remain a vibration. the vibration becomes alive as the universe in your consciousness. It becomes color, taste, smell, all the things that we ascribe to the universe, but which are activities of our consciousness. Okay, so some form of sentience, some form of consciousness is required for manifestation of the vibration into the physical world. It could be anything. It could be a mosquito, or it could be a butterfly, or it could be a honeybee. So a honeybee looks at this flower, it doesn't see the same flower that you and I see, because the honeybee's eye cells do not respond to the wavelengths of light that you and I respond to. But a honeybee can see honey from a distance because it senses in ultraviolet. A snake would experience this as infrared. A bat would experience this as the echo of ultrasound. A chameleon's eyeballs swivel on two different axes. You can't even remotely imagine what this would look like to a chameleon. So what is this? Before you observe it, it is infinite possibilities. In your consciousness, it becomes this. For some other species, it becomes something else. Just take a walk with your dog and you'll see that your dog senses and experiences some things that you and I also are common experiences, and some things the dog will experience that are not common, because sensing a different spectrum of energy and information. So is that clear? Okay? Remember five things. Write them down. I am a field of infinite possibilities. Number two, I know everything. I'm omnipresent, omniscient, omnipotent. Number three, I'm a field of infinite possibilities. I'm omnipresent, omniscient, omnipotent. Number three, I embrace uncertainty. Thank God. Because if you're certain, then you're fixed. There's nothing. I embrace uncertainty. Number four, I have infinite creativity. And number five, I co-create the whole universe with the mystery that we call God. A great Indian teacher, Krishnamurti, somebody heard him once and they said, I think the more I listen to you, I realize you must be an atheist. And Krishnamurti turned to him and he said, I used to be an atheist till I realized I was God. So which annoyed the fundamentalist, because he said, you're denying the divinity of Krishna. In America, we would say, you're denying the divinity of Jesus Christ. And Krishnamurti said, heavens, I've never denied anybody their divinity. Why would you do it to Krishna? You're all divine. We're all divine. Okay. Rumi says, you're not just a drop in the ocean. You're the whole ocean in the drop. Okay. So the great Sufi teachers of Islam said the same thing. That you, your consciousness is a movement in the infinite consciousness. And we are all contained in that infinite consciousness. Okay. We're sharing the same breath right now. We're sharing the same molecules right now. We're sharing the same energy field right now, the same information field. And we are all contained in one consciousness. If you really totally get this, then you realize there's nothing other than God. We're all kind of an activity in the mind of God. Everything is happening in one mind. We are members of the same body. We are members of the same energy field. We are members of the same information field. We have the same breath that we share, which the Jews call Ruach Adonai. The Muslims call Ru. The Hindus call Brahman. The Greeks call Kanephma. One spirit. One spirit. And the goal here at this end of this week is to totally get that. Okay, not just intellectually. And when I say intellectually, you're pointing here, but your mind is not here. Your mind is outside of time. It's a very big mistake to think that your mind is here. Okay? Okay, so the goal is to get there this week, okay? To get to a very deep, experiential, profound understanding. And I've already mentioned these five principles. Now, let me show you some slides to see if we can... This is the new book, by the way, which is based, just came out 4 weeks ago, and I have a new book coming out tomorrow called The Ultimate Happiness Prescription. They're based on more and more and more understanding of the one thing, and that is spirit consciousness. Every book is about that, you know, it's just a little extension, deeper, deeper understanding consciousness. Okay, I already said that all of reality is a differentiated expression of consciousness. Without consciousness, none of these things. Now, what we learn in this course is that reality is different in different states of consciousness. We'll go deep into different states of consciousness during this course. We'll try and understand what is cosmic consciousness, what is divine consciousness, what is unity consciousness, what is soul consciousness. We'll go. And each level of consciousness creates its own reality. Relationships change or become different when we move to higher states of consciousness, but so does our perception, so does our thinking, so does our cognition, so do our emotions, and so does our biology. Our biology, which means our physical organism, is different in different states of consciousness. Because your physical organism exists in your consciousness. It's an activity in your consciousness. So how many people can see a skull here? And how many people can see a woman sitting at a drawer? What is on the screen? Photons. In fact, the screen itself is made up of photons, right? Even the screen itself is made up of vibrations, right? So the picture is in your consciousness. And whether you see a woman or you see a skull is a choice in consciousness. You make a choice in consciousness and then you recognize the choice you made in consciousness as the picture on the screen. When in reality there is no screen and there is no picture out there. What you're seeing is an activity of yourself in consciousness as either the woman or the skull. How many people can see a man playing a saxophone? A woman? Again, you're not doing anything to the picture of on the screen because there is no picture on the screen. Okay? And there is no screen either. They're both activities in your consciousness, as is your own body. How many people can see a word there? And what's the word? Famous poem of William Blake. We are led to believe a lie when we see with and not through the eye that was born in a night to perish in a night while the soul slept in beams of light. So for most people, their soul is sleeping. This week, wake up the soul so you can see beyond the lie. If you can see it, if you can touch it, if you can taste it, smell it, it's part of the lie. Okay? Don't trust your senses. How many people can see a young woman looking away? How many people can see a mother-in-law? Same picture, a little more interesting. We have the father-in-law, the mother-in-law, and the daughter-in-law. What you see out there is an activity in your own consciousness. How many people can see a bird? A rabbit? this is the world we inhabit these days, because this is the world we have manifested. From a very primitive response that uses our reptilian brain, 300 million years old. When I was in medical school, we used to remember this brain as the four Fs: feeding, fighting, fleeing, and reproduction. And the projection of this state of consciousness is this world. Whether it's war, terrorism, poverty, all the epidemics of humankind, eco-destruction, it's an expression of a fragmented consciousness, a fragmented collective consciousness. But this could be another world that we create. That we move from that fragmented state of consciousness to a higher consciousness where we experience ourselves as how we really are. Is this the real body or is that the real body? Well, the physical body that you experience is experienced in consciousness, right? Can you experience your light body in consciousness? Sure, that's a choice. Just so like you saw the woman or the skull, you can see your body as this or you can see your body as that. It's a choice in consciousness. In fact, this is the real body. What the ancients called the light body or the astral body, or beyond this, the consciousness body, the subtle body. And it's a subtle shift in consciousness. Just like when you saw those pictures, it was a subtle shift in consciousness. This or that. And if a number of us started to experience ourselves the way we really are, then it would be a different world. Okay, because the world is as we are. The world is a projection of our consciousness, just as the body is a projection of the consciousness. Thoughts are a projection of consciousness. It's a choice. It's a subtle shift in consciousness, a subtle intention. You know, when I said, imagine the sunset, that was a subtle intention consciousness. So this week, all week, we'll be practicing sutras, which are subtle shifts in consciousness. Very subtle shifts in consciousness that will change our experience of ourselves. And when we change our experience of ourselves, then because reality is different in different states of consciousness, then we'll change our experience of the world. The world is a phantom, it's a dream in consciousness. Just like everything else is an impermanent expression of consciousness. Consciousness is the only reality. And if you can get familiar with this part of your being, then there is no fear of death, there is no craving, no addiction, there is no resistance, there is just joy, there's creativity, there is infinite energy, because if there is one energy that... Okay, so these are just simple principles that we'll try and understand, because this is the last book, it's an extension, that your body is a process, not a structure. Your body is an energy field. Your genes can be turned on and off. You can change your brain structure. You can change your telomeres, which are little buttons at the end of your chromosomes that shift your genetic biological clock. You can change your relationship with time, because time doesn't exist other than in your consciousness. And that the key to all this transformation in your body is in your own consciousness. And we will also learn that this can only be done by going to the deepest level. When we go to the deepest level, then there is effortless spontaneity in choiceless awareness. Choiceless awareness means you allow the whole universe to flow through you, and you just introduce subtle intention. This whole week, the sutra practice, which comes from the great teachers of yoga, like Patanjali, and even going back in mythology and history to the time of Shiva. Shiva is supposed to be the first yogi. Everything is subtle intention in consciousness. Now you know what subtle intention is. Just a little shift in quality of attention. and that the greatest mystery of the universe is love, which is the essence of our spirit. That when we are experiencing this part of ourselves, our core consciousness, we have boundless imagination and creativity. We invite grace. Grace is synchronicity, good luck, or the great feeling, the great presence, that the divine is always present, and that we are instruments for the evolution of the universe. And the most important principle, that we have a certain energy that never runs out. Okay, because this, the energy of the universe is spiritual energy. It's the elements and forces of the universe. So this week, remember one principle. Is it easy? Is it easy? Is it fun? Am I getting results? If you can say yes to all three things, then you're plugged in. You're tuned in. If it's not easy, if it's not fun, and if you're not getting results, or even one of those things is missing, then you're not plugged in. We are the energy of the universe. We are the infinite creativity of the universe. We are the imagination of the universe. And as again Rumi says, by God, when you find yourself, when you see yourself, by God, when you see your beauty, you'll be the idol of yourself. Okay, now I just want to take you through an exercise. I want to go back to this slide. Okay, can everyone just look at this picture a little bit? Because we're going to do a subtle intention exercise to start this morning. We're going to do a subtle intention exercise so that we want to shift our experience of our own body from being a physical body to a light body in consciousness, which is closer to the reality, okay? So just look at this picture for a few seconds, and then I'm going to take you through an exercise. Okay, now close your eyes and put your attention in your heart. And just for a couple of minutes, let's experience gratitude for all the things that we could be grateful for. Gratitude is a way to unleash spiritual energy. Because when we experience gratitude, then our ego steps out of the way. Your ego cannot dominate you when you're experiencing gratitude. So just think of things that you could be grateful for with your attention in your heart. Let go. Now, everyone in this room has learned primordial sound meditation, the mantra that you received. So, very gently, with your eyes closed, introduce your mantra in your consciousness. It's just a way of going a little deeper. And remember, when you repeat the mantra, it's effortless. There's no concentration. It just comes and goes like any other thought. Okay, let go of the mantra now. and bring your awareness, your consciousness into your whole body. Have awareness in your whole body, consciousness in your whole body, consciousness in every cell of your body. Your whole body is one lively, self-interacting, self-intelligent field of consciousness, of energy, of light. Experience this light in every cell of your body, just as you saw in the picture. But now experience it in your body. And all you have to do is have the subtle intention. Perfect order, perfect harmony, pure consciousness, pure energy, pure light in every cell of the body. Keep your awareness in your body till it bubbles with energy and light. Okay, let go now. Relax into your body. Take a minute or so. Slowly open your eyes. Okay, so from now on, at the end of every meditation, for 2 minutes, have the subtle intention with your eyes closed to experience your light body. Nourish your light body, which is really the first principle of transformation. Nourish your light body at the end of every meditation through subtle intention. The key to transformation this week is choiceless awareness. What is choiceless awareness? No attachment to any outcome. Okay, when you're not attached to any outcome, then the whole universe is flowing through you. It's the highest form of intelligence. And then subtle intention. Just a little intention, let it go. And we'll be learning how to refine that. It's a delicate process, but that's what sutra practice is. We'll be doing it this whole week, with slowly opening every chakra with subtle intention in choiceless awareness. Okay. So we have a little time. Any questions on what we discussed this morning? Yeah? Microphone here.
Spanish, yes. How would you differentiate the concept of consciousness from awareness?
Same thing.
Okay.
Awareness, consciousness, the same thing. Okay, but awareness without thought content is consciousness. Awareness with thought content is perception. Awareness without thought content is pure consciousness. Awareness with thought content is perception. Because without thought you can't have perception. You know, if you're sitting next to somebody at a party and you're having a conversation, then you're listening to each other and you don't hear whatever is happening in the background. But then somebody at the end of the room starts to talk about you. And then even though you're having a conversation with this person, you don't hear a thing which they say, your attention is there, okay, across the room. So without thought, there's no perception. All perception is movement of consciousness, which we call thought.
Consciousness actually the medium that everything is happening?
Is consciousness the medium that everything is happening in? We can say consciousness is the container of the whole universe. But consciousness is the activity of consciousness is what creates the experience of mind, body and the universe. Okay, right now I'm seeing you there. That's a perceptual artifact, a socially induced hallucination. Okay. Actually, I'm having a subtle intention in my consciousness, and I'm experiencing myself as you. But we'll get there slowly. Over here. Anyone?
What's the difference between consciousness and prana?
And?
Prana.
Prana is energy. It's movement of consciousness. Okay. Behind there.
I hope I say this right. What caused us to become?
What caused us to become? Answer is no one knows, but I think it was boredom.
Each one of us?
You know what they say in the Vedanta? They say just as movement is inherent in air, manifestation is inherent in consciousness. Consciousness cannot help conceiving, conceptualizing, and becoming. It's its nature. Restlessness.
How was consciousness created, and is there a differentiation between any of us?
Okay, so consciousness is acausal, which means, which already said, as soon as you say, how is consciousness created? You're talking about space-time. Okay, so consciousness is acausal. Outside space-time has no beginning, has no ending, has the potential for beginnings. Huh? That's really interesting, huh? So God suddenly showed up in the form of a mouse. That was meant to happen. Okay? We're talking about God, so, you know, manifestation in the form of a mouse is an interesting joke. And what's the message? Relax. Laugh. Okay, I was saying consciousness is acausal. It's not created, it's the source of creation. And did you say, second part of your question was? Is there a differentiation between the consciousness of different people? Yes, because there are different activities of the one consciousness, but the activities are different. Okay? This wave different from that wave? Sure. But it's still the behavior of the whole ocean. The rain is also the behavior of the ocean. The rainbow is also the behavior of the ocean. The waves are the, and the puddles, they're all different behaviors of the ocean. Okay, so we'll stop here and then we'll continue. You have one last question here.
Is there a difference between us and the animals?
Is there a difference between us and the animals? Well, just a difference in the level of expression of consciousness. Basically, one consciousness, right? So there's no difference between you, animals, or the microphone that I'm holding. It's all you. So there's no us. There's only the one consciousness.
So is it right to say that everything has awareness? Or it's actually awareness? Everything is in awareness.
Everything is in awareness. Everything is in awareness. And it's the interaction of the awareness with itself that it sees itself as the other. It's a very interesting, the process of creation is very interesting, that in order to have experience.
All right, everybody. I think we got cut off there about 9 seconds before the end. Sorry. I just want to thank you for joining me tonight. I had a wonderful time. This was a great time tonight. And let's close it with a song, okay? This is a song that John wrote about consciousness. Good night, everyone.